On This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's Patent Troll Smackdown Part 2, the NSA Lends an Ear, and all about Microsoft TechEd. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 45, recorded June 10, 2013. Can you hear me now? This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why I love my cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup cost, and RingCentral is $20 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone and get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by TechServe. TechServe assists U.S. businesses of all sizes with their technology needs, including Apple, Avid, Adobe, and HP solutions. Visit techserve.com/twiet and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. And by hover.com. Hover is the reliable domain name registration and management service that's simple, honest, and easy to use. For exceptional customer support and 10% off your new domain name, go to hover.com/enterprise and enter offer code ENTERPRISE. Welcome to TWiet, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the Digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. And as always, I am joined by my absolute stellar core cast, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the evangelist for Thin Links and the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, you've been gone for a while. Welcome back to Honolulu. What have you been doing on your whirlwind tour?
Oh, I've been having this big flurry of travel, starting off with Citrix Synergy and then off to Redmond, Washington. And then, we did some Maker Faire. And I want to give a big TWiet shout out to Detective Devin Mudd in the chat room, I think. He gave me some advice on how to deal with some foreign nationals that were trying to steal tech off my table.
Wow. Okay, that could be an episode in and of itself. In fact, it will be an episode in and of itself. But let's talk about that later. Right now, I want to introduce the other member of our panel, our other co-host, Mr. Curtis Franklin from E3 Radio. Curtis, enterprise efficiency, what's going on in your side of the pond?
Well, I'm enjoying being back in the swamp for a while. Got here late Friday, enjoyed the weekend. I've got a whole week at home before I head back out on the road, this time up to the E2 conference in Boston. If any of the TWiet crew is up there, would love to do a face-to-face and see what's happening in all of that disruptive, communicative, and collaborative technology.
I like that. Disruptive, communicative, and collaborative. We'll stick with that, but first, let's get into the Enterprise Byte. Now, I know there's a big story that's floating around right now, and there's been a lot of knee-jerk reactions. We're not going to get to it till later, because I do want people to take a breath, to relax, to breathe in, breathe out, and go with the flow of the tech. We're not starting with the NSA spying story. We are starting with Prendo Law, with the Troll Redux. That's right. Last week, we talked all about how copyright and patent trolls are destroying industry, or destroying innovation in the country. We used the example of Prendo Law as a copyright troll. We used a few examples of patent trolls to show how it was costing American industry billions upon billions of dollars each year to litigate, to defend, to strategize, to plan, to hold back product cycles in order to make sure you weren't going to get sued. Well, right after our episode, in fact, I think it was 5 hours after we taped, Obama came out and said, look, this is a problem for the nation. We are actually going to get out there. We are going to do something on the federal level to do justice by companies that are defending against copyright and patent trolls. Now, this is an interesting follow-up to a story that we ran last week about Vermont passing their anti-patent troll law, essentially an extension of the consumer rights bill that they've got in that state. Now, at the time, we liked it. We thought it was a great idea. The lawyers we had on the panel, however, were saying this is a good first step. But since patent trials really take place in the federal circuit, it didn't matter if a state was passing that kind of a law. Now that we've got Obama saying, look, we need to push this as a national agenda, it could be different. What we've heard about this is that there's really two components. There are the parts of this new initiative that need to take place with Congress. So it has to be a legislative solution. And there are seven parts to that. And then there are five executive order pieces. Let me list them really quick. Under legislative, they want to require patentees and applications to disclose the real party in interest. In other words, they want people to say who will be benefiting from any particular patent suit that is being filed. The second thing is to provide more discretion to judges in awarding fees to prevailing parties. So in other words, if a judge says, hey, you trolled them, you lost, that judge can really now put down the hammer and say you're paying all their court fees plus X number of fines. They also want to expand the PTS's transitional program, which means that there will be more challenges to patents, to the validity of patents. Also, they want to protect those, and this is a big one, they want to protect those who use off-the-shelf solutions. In other words, if I use an operating system developed by somebody else, I can't be sued if that operating system is then found to be infringing because I just used their solution. This is a nice way to say, if you really, really, really believe that something infringes on your technology, go after the people who made it, not after the people who are using it. They also want to change the ITC standards for obtaining an injunction, which actually provides a nice balance against patent trolls and people who really are honestly trying to protect their intellectual property. And finally, I like this one. They want to get the ITC some talent. This is a story that we also ran on Twit a while back that was talking about how these patent trolls are so successful because anybody with talent for this sort of law is on the wrong side. Now, I want to throw this to you first, T-Bert. I know this is one of your rants. This is one of the things that you hate. You do not like trolls at all. What do you think about these seven legislative items?
Oh, I think it's a great start. And my personal opinion is getting the patent office and the prosecuting office some talent so that they can actually go after these trolls and, you know, don't stick their foot in their mouth. You know, that's the big issue. All the really, really good lawyers on patent and so forth are making some serious, serious money. And unfortunately, the government just can't compete. It's the same thing with technology. And that's the big reason why the NSA and the CIA and so forth have gotten special dispensations to try and raise the amount of money, raise the stakes so they can actually hire some talent. This is not like the old days when you just go to Harvard and, you know, you wave the flag around and people will just jump and serve the national interest.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, nowadays, people are a lot more mercenary about it. And the unfortunate thing is it's going to take the holy dollar to get talent in there to help defend the nation's intellectual property.
Curtis, let me go over to you and specifically to one of these legislative provisions. That's number four, protecting those who use off-the-shelf solutions. This is a lot alike what Google and Rackspace announced with their mutual defense agreements. Basically, if you use our solutions, we will protect you in case you get sued. Now we're saying it in federal law, it's going to become federal law, which is if you use something that someone else offers, you receive a level of indemnity against being sued by patent trolls. What does that change in the game? It basically means that I don't have to worry about being the little guy if I'm using a solution created by a big guy, right?
Well, it goes even beyond that. It means that as the consumer of technology, you don't have to worry about being sued for patent infringement. You basically get protection from the vendor, regardless of whether they're bigger or smaller or the same size as you are. And I think that's critical for the comfort level of CIOs, CTOs, and even CFOs all the way across the executive suite, because that means that they can go ahead and look for the products and technologies that best suit their purposes without worrying about whether there's some obscure patent somewhere that will cause them to have to expend money and effort to have their legal department deal with it. Now, from the patent troll point of view, this is just devastating because they were really using this very novel approach to provide leverage. You know, they were going after the offending, as they saw it, companies that manufactured things, but really using that company's customers to provide leverage against them. This takes away that fulcrum point in the law And I think it evens the playing field, puts it back where it really belongs.
I like that. I like that idea of extending protection, of actually promoting innovation by making it very clear what you are claiming within your patent. Now, let's move on to the executive segment of this story. There are five executive orders that Obama wants to issue. The first is to make real party in interest. That's sort of the same idea of saying if you're going to sue someone, if you're going to claim a patent, you need to make it clear who owns this patent and what it does. The second one is to tighten functional claiming. I believe this is actually about overly broad patents, those who deliberately make their patents vague in order to be able to sue as many people as possible. The third one is empowering downstream users. This is a lot like that number four under the legislative solution, where you are essentially saying we are going to make sure that if you are using someone else's solution, you should be protected by law. The next part is to expand dedicated outreach and study. This is actually a nice way of saying we need to be able to look more broadly at what is being patented, what innovation is taking place before we actually start making legislation. And the fifth one is to strengthen enforcement process of exclusion orders, and that deals all with the ITC. What I like about these five executive orders is they don't reach that far into the powers of Congress. So it makes it a nice balance between the seven things being asked of Congress and the five things that the president wants to do on his own. My question to you, Chiebert, is this. Say this were to become the law of the land. Let's say that companies start operating under the idea that they are going to be protected insofar as they follow a very clear set of rules. What does that do to innovation? What does that do to the small company that wants to create a startup? What does that do to the company that can't afford a patent portfolio to defend themselves against the bigs?
You know, that's one of the great things about America. There are a whole bunch of people out there that want to help, but have been, shall we say, iced out or blocked away from helping out. You know how we have things like, you know, the Legal Defense Fund and so forth, where we have lawyers that are volunteering for community service. I've started seeing more and more people saying, hey, you know, we've got some expertise and I'm willing to step up to help. I'm hoping executive orders like this and legislations like this will give us the ability to take advantage of the expertise. Just going into the discussion in the interrupt knock list, there's been an awful lot of people who said, hey, this is really stupid legislation. I'd love to be able to do something about it. Right. Things like this means maybe we'll have people stepping up. And I think volunteerism in America is fine and good and healthy as heck.
Yeah. Curtis, let me actually open that up to you, because one of the provisions here is this idea of making things more public. If you're going to claim that you own a piece of IP, the law may now require you to make it public, to publicly state your claim and allow everyone to actually look at it in an easy-to-understand format. Do you see that as increasing this wave of volunteerism? There are so many geeks like myself who will jump on something like the latest EFF campaign to fight against a patent troll and say, look, can you help us find prior art? Can you help us find all the mistakes in their patent application? Do you see that being a new wave of tech volunteerism?
Well, I think perhaps tech volunteerism, but more important, I see this as very clearly defining things. You know, traditionally, companies had a couple of options when it came to protecting their intellectual property. One was the patent system, in which you enlisted the government to help you enforce a patent of limited duration, during which you had exclusive control over your invention, the idea being that in return for that, at the end of that exclusionary period, it was released to the common good. The other option was the trade secret, and that gets into things like the classic one is the formula for Coca-Cola. That's not patented because patenting it would require them to divulge it. What we've seen in recent years is companies that tried to have it both ways, keeping things secret until they essentially had an ambush patent claim. This takes that strategy away, and I think it's very good. If a company wants to have a trade secret, they're welcome to do so. There's plenty of case law, plenty of established policy on how to do that. But if they want the protection of a patent, then they've got to play by those patent rules. And that means disclosing not only what the patent is and claims to do, but who owns it.
I like that. Well, I want to bring this to a close because we're not done with patent trolls, but I think that we can say, look, now that the federal government is getting involved, I'm not saying the federal government can solve all problems, but I think it's an encouraging step that we see this as a problem, not just for Silicon Valley, not just for a couple of states, but for our country as a whole. So let's move on. Now, coming right up, we are going into that spy case. We're going to be talking about the NSA. We're going to be talking about tapping, but we're going to take a quiet angle. Before then, I do want to take some time to talk about our first sponsor, and that's RingCentral. Now, we do everything in the cloud. It's just who we are. We wanted to do that dog fooding thing, where if we're telling people to move their services into the cloud, move their data into the cloud, we believe that we should do the same thing. And so we do all our scheduling in the cloud. We have our email in the cloud, our calendar, our docs, everything we possibly can push into the cloud, we have done. And so when Russ, our IT guy, went to Leo and said we could have our PBX system in the cloud as well, well, it was a no-brainer. We love RingCentral. There are zero startup costs. There's no PBX hardware to install or maintain. RingCentral allows us to customize all of our call handling. Our producers can get their voicemail and their emails, and we can even get our fax messages right on our smartphones. And now they have a new feature, RingCentral Conferencing. Get your own single conference bridge number ready for unlimited conference calls for up to 1,000 participants. Lots of features. You can mute participants, get caller count, record conferences, and more. It's easy to use, works with your desk phone, iPhone, or Android, or RingCentral soft phone. It's free with your monthly service. A RingCentral offers you all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 per month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial, and they have a special offer for my listeners. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free, up to 20 phones. So call this number, designated for my listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com. Use the promo code TWIT. And we thank RingCentral for their support of this week in enterprise tech. Now let's get into it. This is a story that we have to cover. I know it's been covered ad nauseum. And if you want to hear a lot of the back and forth, we've had some great back and forth here on the TWIT network. Go to last Friday's TNT. Go to last Friday's Twill. Go to this weekend's The Tech Guy or TWIT. There were some great discussions on the ethical, moral, legal implications. But I kind of want to pull a little bit away from that because so much of that is knee-jerk, reactionary, emotional outpouring. I want to talk about the tech. I want to talk about what this means for the enterprise. Now, here's the story in a nutshell. We have a NSA leaker who has outed himself, a man by the name of Edward Snowden. He was an NSA contractor, and he basically released a few slides. I believe it was two slides out of a 44-slide PowerPoint deck explaining how the government has been spying on its citizens. Now, I say spying, but we can look at it multiple ways. They've been taking metadata. They've been looking at connections between phone numbers and social media accounts. We're not really sure. We don't have all of the information behind what they were doing. But I think here on TWIT, because we are enterprise guys, because we're networking guys, we can actually talk a little bit about what this means. Now, we've actually had the DNI, the Director of National Intelligence, declassify certain PRISM documents to clear up a misinformation that he believes was put out there by Edward Snowden. In his statement, he said that PRISM is an internal government computer system used to facilitate the government's statutory authorized collection of foreign intelligence information from electronic communication service providers under court supervision. That's in stark contrast to what Snowden was saying, which was basically PRISM was going forth and getting a back door, a direct connection to everyone's data center. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this over to you because this is always a little bit puzzling for enterprise guys when we have people freak out about data being collected as it passes over our networks. Because when we set up something like Interop, which I think is pretty typical of most enterprise class networks, we capture everything, don't we?
You bet. We actually, in a lot of cases, actually record everything that goes in and out on certain major circuits. Now, in our case, what we're doing is being able to record this so that we have the ability, say if someone comes back and says, hey, yesterday at 10 o'clock, my network connection really stank. We can actually go back and look at that segment and find out what the heck's going on. Now, we don't tend to record 100%. We tend to only record metadata. We want to see what's happening on the connection. We want to see what's happening on the so-called envelope, you know, all the headers and so forth of that data. We just don't have the money or the disk space to be able to record 100% of everything, especially since last year we did 100 gig connection.
I like that. That's actually a really good point. At Interop, we don't have the money or the disk space to capture. If we could, if we had an unlimited budget, if we had an unlimited number of servers and SANs, we would prefer to capture each and every single packet because the more information we have, the better that we can run the network, the better that we can manage it. That's just one of the facts about network work, which is the more data you have, the better decisions you can make. Curtis, let me throw this over to you. When we think about enterprise networking, we think about centralized IT departments. We think about men in suits who make high-level decisions, which are then passed down to managers. Do most enterprises have a belief that the traffic being passed over their network is being recorded in some way or another, that there's a log that they can go back to find out who did what when?
Well, most enterprise networks that I have looked at have different levels of that. Most of them, for example, will absolutely keep all of the email that goes in and out. The vast majority will keep all of the instant messaging that goes out, files of various sorts, attachments, all of that, absolutely. Where they tend not to keep everything comes down to voice over IP, the phone calls. Many of them, the technological capability to grab it is there. But as you and Chiebert have noted, once you grab it, you need to do something with it. And most companies are able to afford enough to keep a rolling, minute and a half of phone conversations sitting on their disks. So typically, they won't try to do that unless they've got some legally compelling reason to do so. You know, if they've got a court order, if they feel like they have discovery, and for all of that, they want to have policies in place that say, we don't do this normally, so don't come looking for it.
Yeah. What I like about what you just said is, in talking about VoIP, we did cover a story on Twiat not too long ago about how the last circuit switch in the country was being replaced. That as of, I believe, last week, every single call in the United States is now some form of VoIP. Now, I've got a couple of things in front of me. These are taps. We can go into the product camera and get a much closer look at what these things look like. We covered these a few episodes back. In fact, one of the very first episodes of Twiat. These are sort of fundamental pieces of hardware that everyone who does any sort of network work is going to have to be able to use, tapping the copper and the fiber in your network. What I'd like to do now is do a rerun of a pre-recorded segment we did way back when in the old days of Twiat to, bring back the idea of the tap.
I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, host of Twiat, This Week in Enterprise Tech on the Twit Network. And this is another edition of the Data Closet. Now, a while back, we had a stuff my IT guy says that we talked about taps, these devices that allow us to capture traffic or tap traffic from one part of the network to another. Phenomenally useful tools that are absolutely necessary in the kit of any enterprise professional, but some people asked exactly what they could do with it. I mean, the theory is nice, but they wanted to see nuts and bolts. How do they make a tap work for them? So we're here at the Hotstage Warehouse for Interop, building one of the world's most advanced temporary networks, and I thought we'd have a chat with a NetOptics engineer, Mr. Aaron Engerbretson. Aaron, thank you very much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Now, you know a little bit about taps.
Yep.
You've been doing this for years and years and years. Tell me, what is useful about a tap?
Well, a tap, it basically becomes the wire. So it's, you are looking at the packets as they go across the wire.
Right. So it's really, it really is a wiretap. That's where the name comes from. Now, one of the things that we mentioned in the Stuff My IT Guy Says episode is that a network tap, a true network tap, is the only way to get well, uncorrupted information. I mean, if you have an inline device, it could fail. If you have a network span, it could get overloaded. But with a network tap, it's pure. It doesn't decrease the TTL of a packet. It just passes through and gives you a copy of whatever it is you wanted a copy of.
That's right.
Show me what a practical application of a tap would be.
All right. So what we have here set up is we have a VoIP telephone and our network. So we have tapped in between the phone and the network. Mm-hmm. So now we're going to see all the packets from the voice traffic go through the tap. So I'll go ahead and start my Wireshark trace. So now we'll see the packets as they go across the wire.
And now I have a number to dial.
All right.
So go ahead.
I'll go ahead and dial my cell phone. All right.
And I'm starting to see the packets flow here.
That's right. As you can see, the RTP, that's the real-time protocol.
And now I'm talking, and you should be able to hear me. However, if my partner speaks,
you will not hear what I say.
And the reason why you can't hear what he's saying on this stream is because we're using a non-aggregating port. So if you look down at the switch right now, we've got our inbound network, we've got the phone, and we've got the tap only plugged in on the B side. That's the outbound side. So when Aaron speaks,
you won't hear it on the wire trace.
And that's how that works. Now, this is a phenomenally useful tool because I get to see the traffic. I get to see what's going on, but that's not the only thing that Wireshark can do.
That's right. We see all the packets as it goes across the wire. So actually, let's go ahead and stop this trace. And we'll come to telephony within here, and we'll look for voice calls, anything that's gone across the wire. So here it found a call. I'm going to go ahead and select that call. You can see where the call originated from, its SIP ID, and then who we were calling. I can actually play this within Wireshark.
Okay. Now, one of the really cool things about this is that it's not just, well, it's not just a violation of civil liberties, but it's a really useful tool if you're trying to troubleshoot voice packet problems across the network. If you've got a VoIP system and you can't figure out why it keeps dropping packets or why it sounds horrible, capture a session and you can actually see what the packets are doing at the wire. It gives you a much better idea of what's going on your network.
Yeah, we get a lot of statistics from those packets themselves. Also, you can also hear the call yourself and see if you hear that same jitter or that noise on the wire.
Now, this is not a tool limited just to VoIP. You've actually got a NetOptics tool that shows what's going on at Interop. Can we take a look at that?
Absolutely. We're collecting all the packets here at Interop. And so from those packets, I can see who are the top talkers on the network, who's using my bandwidth, what are they doing, what are they downloading, are they conversations or calls, anything, illegal BitTorrents. You can see who IP addresses, how they're talking to each other, how much traffic is going across on these communications. Volume utilization, so you can see over time if you need more and more bandwidth. This will tell you, it'll even generate you a report that you can then hand to your manager and say, look, we're running out of space here, so give me another circuit.
What I like about this is, well, for a lot of networks, it's sort of a black box. You know, you've got externals, you've got clients, but it either works or it doesn't.
Right.
And it's hard to quantify what you need. And do I need to expand my internal links? Do I need bigger pipes to the internet? Do I need to segment my network so I have more zones so I can partition off heavy traffic use? If I'm using taps, I can actually show my manager using your screen or using Wireshark and say, look, I'm getting an abundance of traffic here, here, and here. This is where we need to add capacity. It's an extraordinarily useful network tool, and it's really fundamental.
Definitely.
Yeah. Now, if they want to find out more about taps, of course, the best place for them to go is to find someone like you. Find an engineer, find someone who does this for a living, and they'll tell you all about taps. Or they could go to a conference. And I know I beat on this drum a lot, but find us. We'll both be at Interop. Go to the knock on the window, and ask us about what NetOptics can do for your network. But if you want some free material, I believe NetOptics has a few resources on their website.
Definitely. You can go to www.netoptics.com. We have case studies and white papers you can read up on also.
Fantastic. Aaron, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
I hope you understand why you need to have taps in your network. I'm Father Robert Ballester, and until next time, this is the Data Closet.
Cheebert, it really is that simple. I mean, this is not an expensive box. This is not the only box that can do this. You could do this with something as simple as a hub if you really want to play with Wireshark and what you can see on your network. But a few interesting comments have come up in the chat room while we were watching that video. TV's Egon was talking about how, well, as long as you've got encryption, you're fine. As long as the government doesn't have taps directly on the line, you're fine. But, we can't really trust that, right? I mean, all you need is a big enough server farm, and you can aggregate all the data from all the taps from all the telcos.
Yeah, you bet. You know, the whole issue is high-density taps exist. A lot of telcos actually have tapping infrastructure built in strictly for diagnostics. So repurposing those for listening in isn't that hard. It's just a matter of scale. You know, how much are you willing to hold on to? Sometimes you're only rolling maybe a 10-second window for diagnostics or so forth. Even in the days when I had, you know, the certain types of clearances, you tap for diagnostics and you tap for keywords, you tap for things like that. You don't tap to hold it. There's exactly. just too much yeah. stuff.
And actually, we saw that at the beginning of the video. We saw the header of the VoIP stream. It said, okay, where's it coming from? Where's it going to? And it gave us other pieces of information. Typically, on the interop net, that's the only thing that we would hold on to. We want to see when a call was established, when a call was dropped. That's all we care about because we are space limited. But now we've got this story that was actually released last year from Wired about this brand spanking new data center that the NSA was building in Utah. It's done now. It's finished. And it's huge. It's $2 billion. It's 1 million square feet. Now, Ken, Cheebert, let me ask you to engage your imagination here without too much speculation. Can you imagine what you might fill a million square feet with?
That is one hell of a big data center. And I bet you the thermal bloom off that from satellites is just amazing.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, it's unless we start having a quantum leap in storage capability, like holographic memory, recording everything's just not really possible, even with today's technology. It's just too much stuff. Just look at the speed of those backbones. We're already up to 100 gig backbone. Mm-hmm. That's an awful lot of stuff to store, but it's not an awful lot to scan. You know, scanning on the fly is something that the NSA and people like that have done for a long time. But what a lot of folks keep forgetting is, gee, the terrorists, the bad guys know how to use this stuff too. You know, having an encrypted conversation used to mean you could say anything you want, but that can't be the case all the time. We need to defend ourselves. And, you know, I'm sorry, terrorists do not play by the rules of Marquis of Queens.
Cheebert, I want to ask one more data center question of you, because this was actually brought up in the chat room. Certain people were talking about, well, you can enable encryption on your SIP conversation. You can enable encryption on your VoIP conversation. But as we both know, at some point you have to hand off that call to a provider that's going to put it onto the national network. And typically, provider to provider is not encrypted, is it?
No, typically not. However, say for instance, you want to be able to do SIP trunking and you go SIP to SIP over the internet or over leased lines or whatever. You can have end-to-end encryption. That's not that hard. In fact, a lot of the chat programs actually are lightly encrypted. You know, they might be something as simple as MD5. But using some of the commercial systems, say like the ones from Avaya or Siemens or so forth, you can have end-to-end encryption, which means at least, you know, Joe Schmo with a tap is going to have to work really, really hard to perhaps do a man in the middle and get that encryption key. You know, this is the type of stuff that gives the people like the NSA nightmares, because right. Then they've got to go and put an awful lot of CPU time to crack those keys.
By the way, yeah,
maybe it's worth it.
For the guys in the chat room who are talking about, well, why don't you just use a man in the middle attack? This is a hardware man in the middle attack. That's all that a tap is. A tap allows traffic to flow through as it would normally if there was nothing there, but it gives me copies of both the inbound and the outbound traffics. This is a man in the middle in a box. Curtis, let me go over to you. And this is where we start getting into this delicate transition between, okay, this is the tech behind listening to conversations or watching traffic. And this is readily available. We've all known about this. I mean, if you've been watching our program, you've known that even some low-level geek like myself has access to this kind of hardware. My question is, in an enterprise, when you sign your EULA, when you start working that very first day and the guy from HR comes over and has you sign off the acceptable use policy of the technology at the office, basically we know anything we do on our network can be watched, right? If I'm surfing a site I should not be surfing, I can get penalized for that. If I'm making calls that I should not be making, that can be logged. That's part of the enterprise mythos, right? We know that we're being watched.
Absolutely. I mean, if it's not explicitly stated, let's all admit that the rational position to take is that if it happens on my workplace network, especially if it happens on a workplace computer, then there is an extent to which the data, the traffic, and the transactions belong to the company. That's just basic common sense. The people who say, oh, I had no idea that when I went to pick your favorite disgusting porn site, it would show up on, you know, HR's radar screen. They're showing a level of naivete that doesn't really do them any sort of compliment.
All right. So then my question, and this is an open question to the both of you, is that why we're seeing much less of a freak out from the enterprise side? Yes, this is a big story. I mean, this is a big story to know what the government is doing. And I'm all for transparency. Don't get me wrong. I actually do fall more on the EFF side of the issue. But coming from the enterprise side, I just always assumed someone would be watching my traffic. I just always assumed that you'd be able to see my source routes and see the destination of my packets. Is that why you don't see a huge outcry from the enterprise world? I don't see enterprise radio saying, okay, this is the end of networking as we know it. I don't see people from Slashdot saying, well, this is going to destroy business across the country. Why is there such a discrepancy between what the personal citizen might feel and the enterprise side feels?
I'd like to take that first, if I could.
Sure.
I think that there are several reasons. Number one is that most companies of any size in the U.S. are already pretty heavily regulated. They're used to the idea that a regulatory compliance auditor is going to come in, make sure that their data is available to regulators, to various law enforcement people. This is something that they're just used to on the enterprise level. There's also the fact that there's not that much, because of those regulations, that they are sending back and forth that they can legally keep private from government regulators and law enforcement people. Now, the one place where things could get interesting tends to be on the financial side, especially international finances. And here's why I think we haven't heard a whole lot from them. Many of those companies are already using private networks, up to and including private fiber plants that they have paid to have pulled on transoceanic circuits. Those things are much more difficult for organizations like the NSA to sit there and sniff. So those IT folks feel that they have an appropriate level of security. The rest of the enterprise just doesn't care.
All right, T-Bert, I have to throw this to you because I can feel you smiling from across the ocean. Tapping transatlantic, transpacific cables, fibers. Have we ever done anything like that?
Oh, you know we have. our friends at the CIA actually had a special submarine that sat on the ocean, actually on a river floor, as came up a river in Russia, and they had a pressurized moon pool so that the fiber optic taps could be installed into a repeater that the Russians had put, you know, laid in this river. It's doable. It's hard, but it's doable. The reality is we need to be able to defend ourselves. And corporate America really and truly has wanted to defend themselves. Because the problem is, you know, we actually had a case, you know, not too terribly long ago where a person was viewing kiddie porn. And the problem is, if the organization didn't do anything about it, they can be held liable for along with the offender. So a lot of corporations are trying to defend themselves against idiots that are going to do something like kiddie porn. So yeah, corporate America is already monitoring, and it's a lot of it's self-defense.
Right. All right. Well, let me go back to the well a little bit again, because again, we're still talking about taps. One of the questions that came up in the chat room, and I think this is a good teaching moment, is we've got Illuminati who's saying, well, he just set up a span port or a mirror port on his switch, and it basically does the same thing as a tap. That's actually a good point. We do have an episode. I believe it's episode 10 of Twite. If you want to learn all about the different ways to tap, to put a device in line, to have a tap like this, or to have a mirror point, a mirror port, it actually explains the differences. But really quickly, if you're using a span or a mirror port, it's a nice way of using the power of the switch itself. Let's say I have a 24-port switch. I can set it up so that one of the ports, its job is just to mirror other ports, just to give me all the data that's coming through those ports. Very cool tech, which is very flexible, but the problem has always been that it's very easy to overload that port. Let's say it's a 1 gigabit switch. I only have 1 gigabit of data coming down from the switch to the device I'm using to record, but there's actually 2 gigabits of data transferring per port. So it's very easy to overload. That's why we use taps like this, non-aggregating taps, so I can capture separately each side of the conversation. Now, that got really, really technical really, really quickly, but the reason why we're talking about it is, again, to get back to Chiebert's original idea that we're not recording everything. Even with a huge data center in the middle of Utah, there's so much data being transferred over a network today. It's just unfeasible to be able to record each and every single conversation, each and every single packet stream. So I guess that's a long-winded way of saying just calm down, relax. I do want to move away from this topic before it gets into a moral, ethical debate on whether or not the government should be spying on us. But what would be your last words to enterprises that might be worrying about what the government is collecting on their business activity? Does this change the way you operate? Should this change the way you store data? Should this change the way that you use cloud services? Chiebert, let me start with you.
No, there's really no change. All this is someone saying, bringing out of the shadows that the government is actually doing something they've been doing for years. As technology changes, so does the tapping technology. We have to monitor.
I like that. Okay, we have to monitor. Curtis, over to you. Does this change it from the executive side? Do you see executives freaking out, or are they just going to say, wow, we've been doing this way longer than the government?
Well, I think most executives are going to be, first of all, not at all surprised. As Chiebert says, this is the sort of thing that I think most people have assumed that the government was doing for years. The only people that I can see who have any real concern about this are those who are involved in certain types of international transactions who have to worry about the privacy laws on the other side of particularly the Atlantic. I can imagine that a bunch of those folks are in the process of having calls with their solicitors these days, basically to reassure themselves that they cannot be held liable for anything that might be recovered out of a stream that is initiated by one of their customers. Aside from that, from the enterprise side, this is, if not a non-event, certainly not a huge event.
I like that. And I was ready to move away from the topic, but then Lawn Dog in the chat room drew me back in. He asked the question, Padre, we may not have the technology to collect all that data today, but what is going to happen in the next 5 or 10 years or more? So essentially he's saying, look, we may not have the storage capability now, but as storage expands, as it grows, as it advances, eventually we may have the ability to collect each and every single stream. My question, to Brian or Curtis, I'm going to make this an open question, is does that really change anything? I mean, we've always had this sort of cat and mouse game. Yes, we do collect information. Yes, we will record things. But what is your reasonable expectation of privacy in a digital world? Brian, start with you.
If it's on your private network, yeah, I would say it's private. But once it gets outside the organization, really, do you really have an expectation of privacy? It is public. Unless you're going to lay your own fiber, unless you're going to run encrypted pipes, say, IPsec VPNs between all your locations, you know, it's pretty public. You know, all it takes is just some idiot to run a copy of Squid, and you have a man-in-the-middle attack. You have taps. You have lots of different things out there. So, yeah, if you are expecting privacy, then expect to pay for, you know, solid encryption.
Curtis, in a digital world, what are your reasonable expectations of privacy?
Well, I think that people have a level that they would like to expect, and it's somewhat higher than the level that exists. Here's the real problem. Most people are pretty comfortable with the idea of the government in whatever guise protecting them from terrorists. The problem comes when all of this data can be collected and stored, and you correctly say, if we can't do it now, eventually we will be able to. We just know with the march of progress that that's going to happen. I have heard law professors say that there are so many laws on the books now that no citizen and no company fails to break a federal law on pretty much a daily basis. With that being the case, the question of trust comes up. Do we trust the data to stay within the confines of the terrorist fighting organizations? This ultimately comes down to that trust issue. And that's where this debate is taking us. And I think it's a very good debate to have. It's going to be interesting to see where it ends up, and that's almost certainly beyond the scope of this show or even a technology issue. But it is a debate that we're going to have, and I can hardly wait to see the outcome.
We have to move away from this topic because I do want to cover the happenings at Microsoft TechEd, but I will say that this situation has sparked a new episode or series of episodes that we're going to be running starting in August. We will actually be showing you how to use inexpensive, practically available hardware to do high-spec, military-spec, point-to-point VPN secure encryption between branches and enterprises, branches and branches, homes and offices, etc. It's all a nice way of saying, look, in this kind of world, in this kind of trust-no-one environment, you really have to trust no one. You really do have to take care of your own privacy if it matters to you. Now, we're going to come right back with some more coverage of Microsoft TechEd, all the goodness that Chebert and Curtis picked up in New Orleans. But before that, I want to take time to talk about the second sponsor of this episode's Twiet. Now, we don't talk enough about Apple. I know we really should. Apple is a mover and a shaker. There are so many corporations that are finding their solutions to be useful for many different environments, everything from vertical markets to kiosks to just BYOD goodness in the office. So when TechServe came to us and said that they wanted to be a sponsor of the Twiet Riot, well, I jumped. As New York's premier authorized Apple reseller and technology provider, TechServe serves creative professionals at all levels, from individual customers to Fortune 100 companies. TechServe carries a full range of Apple products, from iPhones and iPads to iMacs, MacBooks, iPods, and accessories. TechServe also has a range of partnerships with top vendors to facilitate flexible, efficient, and creative solutions for all of your business needs. TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple, Avid, and Adobe solutions throughout the United States, whether you're already committed to iPads or just getting started. From sales to support, process to practice, TechServe can help. Some amazing technology solutions are being deployed on iPads right now. If you've been to the Delta terminals in LaGuardia, Toronto, or Minneapolis, and I've actually been to all of those, you may have noticed nearly every seat in the terminal is equipped with an iPad. Travelers can now sit anywhere in the terminal and receive real-time flight updates on the iPad, or use them to order food, play games, browse the internet, and check email while they're waiting. Over 1.5 million visitors used these iPads in Delta's terminals just this past year. The result has been a double-digit increase in food and beverage revenue and the highest customer satisfaction scores of all participating airports. OTG Management is the hospitality company behind Delta's terminals. They've turned to TechServe to provide, configure, and install the world's largest deployment of iPads, a number that just keeps growing as they add new terminals. And TechServe really was the natural place to turn. They sell, support, personalize, configure, and manage massive iPad projects. From the Delta terminals to a school with 700 chef instructors to an operation that delivered personally configured iPads to 3,000 cable technicians. TechServe is able to do a full life cycle management for all of your technology needs by providing the devices that you need, getting them up and running, teaching you and your staff how to effectively use them, and maintaining them so that they're working efficiently. TechServe also provides ongoing support so that if your enterprise has a problem, help is just a phone call away. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, why not ensure the project's success with the world's most experienced partner? If your business is considering integrating iOS technology at your workplace, contact TechServe today and receive a complimentary iPad deployment assessment. Visit techserve.com/twiet, and TechServe will help you assess your current or future iPad needs and give you advice to make it a success. That's techserve.com/twiet. One more time, techserve.com/twiet. And we thank TechServe for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to the fun part, the real geek out segment of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Curtis, Brian, both of you were at Microsoft Tech Ed in New Orleans, and I heard it was an absolute playground of everything Microsoft. I want to start with you, Curtis. What would you say is the number one thing? What was the thing that just shook you, that caught you, that seemed to be the biggest impact?
You know, the thing that I really came away from Tech Ed impressed by was the Microsoft focus on security. This is something where they have done what Microsoft traditionally does. They see a problem and they just iterate on a solution over and over and over again. And if the market doesn't move away from them, ultimately they end up doing something that's a pretty darn good job. The thing that really fascinated me was getting to sit down with people who were genuinely excited about the security aspects. They are looking at ways to solve a lot of the enterprise problems with security, all the way from authentication to user privileges to how to deal with BYOD. And the complete spectrum of things that they were doing there were really impressive and, I think, do a good job of making the Windows 8 and Windows Server 2012 combination a very powerful set of tools for enterprises who want to have solid, secure computing environments for their employees.
I like that. Solid, secure computing environments. T-Bert, I think you actually made a couple of comments in our earlier conversations about what you saw falling under that category.
Actually,
and he's holding
I'm
it.
Going to first say that, you know, the biggest issue, the biggest event at TechEd were the three-hour-long lines for all the geeks at the show to go and buy a 75% off Microsoft Surface Pro and Surface RT, one per person.
Yes, yes. And actually, if you watched any of the coverage, you saw those lines. But, of course, that was a great opportunity for you to network, right? You could talk to your fellow geek and find out why they were in line for a Surface RT, Surface Pro. Let me ask you this. Did anyone buy just one or the other? No, everyone bought both, yeah?
Actually, I did see, especially foreign nationals, only buying the RT version.
Really?
I'm not sure why. The bulk of the Americans bought a full set. And I actually didn't have a chance to ask them why only the RT version. I would have thought they would have bought only the Pro version, but I don't know.
Actually, this is a tangent, but let's go down the rabbit hole a little bit. There was a lot of speculation when the RT and the Pro were released that if Microsoft would have used, I don't know, half of the $1.6 billion that they set forward to advertise those tablets to instead be a little bit of a subsidy to get the numbers up, to get those units out there, to get them into the hands of people who could actually grow to love them, it would have been a much better campaign. And the numbers that I heard would have put the pricing of the RT not at $100, but maybe at $200, and would have put the Surface Pro closer to that $500 price point. At those price points, do you think we would have actually seen a success from the Surface Pro and the Surface RT?
Oh, you bet. Just seeing those insane lines, and I actually waited in those insane lines myself, there's a lot of comments about, well, gee, maybe Microsoft has finally found the correct price point for the Surface. I don't think that's too far off. You know, a lot of people are saying, yeah, it's at 75% off, you can't pass it up. But if they had gone and said, you know, instead of the Surface RT being, you know, what it is, you know, get it down into the $200 range, it might have actually taken market away from things like the Nexus 7.
Yeah.
And I tell you, having that full-size screen is really nice, and I actually really do like the touch-type keyboard.
Well, I mean, think about it. A $200 tablet that comes with Microsoft Office, who's not going to get that? Curtis, did you get both units at Tech Ed?
No, I have hit the point where I'm not reviewing products a lot right now, and I have some other uses for fun, so I didn't get both. But I'll admit, have a real aversion to standing in line for 3 hours for much of anything. So I didn't, but I was very impressed. And I agree with Brian. If not this particular price point, I think what we saw was a real statement that there is a price point at which people can become truly excited about the Surface tablets, but both flavors. And that presents a real dilemma, I think, for a lot of vendors out there who have pro-type tablets going, gee, what are we going to do? How much do we trade off our margins, which are already, in most cases, pretty thin, versus volume? It's a fascinating market-specific problem, and I have a feeling that in about 5 years, there are going to be some great MBA class case studies to come out of this.
Yeah. I guess the other real question here is, if you didn't get them both, could I have paid you to stay in line and gotten both for me?
Without question. I like to tell people I am easy. I'm just not cheap.
That's right, folks. Missed opportunity. Now, let's get back to off the tangent. Let's get back into some of the meat of Tech Ed. Chibert, tell me all about Azure services for Windows Server 2012.
Well, the easiest way to look at it is, let's go to that first slide. The concept is, now you can have the same types of services on your private cloud that you have in the public cloud. It's just as easy. It's just as easy to delegate the responsibility to, say, department heads or project heads. So now that I can go and have a consistent experience, whether I'm in a public or private cloud. But most importantly, I have the ability to replicate either in the direction of the public cloud, or if I'm in the public cloud, replicate to the private cloud. Being able to have this cross cloud experience is a very, very powerful tool. And not only that, I can actually provision in one place on the same interface so that I don't have to relearn another interface. It's actually pretty good. And I should point out, gee, this is almost like they're taking some planks out of the platform of the OpenStack people. Now, when you start getting into OpenStack as a topic, you go into what's demonstrated in the slide number 2. Slide 2 starts talking about, gee, now I can start using the same interface for my cloud so I can control my top of rack networks. The concept of hybrid networking, being able to, from a single interface, be able to control things like the Generation 8 HP switches, the Generation 8 Blade servers. I had a long conversation with some folks on the Cisco Blade team, and they're actually pretty excited about this because they actually really don't want to have to write more software because that cuts into their bottom line. And it's the same, a lot of the same driving forces that you have with OpenStack. People don't want to have separate consoles for a lot of different things it's all associated anyway. I still need control of the switches, the top of rack switches. I still need control of my storage area networks. I still need control of my blade systems. Wouldn't it be nice to be able to do it from a single console? And I think that's where Microsoft is getting into. Now it's number 3. Remember, everybody talks about Microsoft. It takes them 3 good chances to actually get it right. I think this is try number 3, and I think they've hit a home run.
I like that. Actually, let's dive a little bit deeper into that, because some people still don't understand the difference between open cloud, private cloud, public cloud, private cloud, and why it's such a good idea to be able to move between the two so seamlessly, to be able to replicate your data from your closed servers up into the cloud, test them out, bring them back down, etc. What's the primary advantage to me of being able to do that?
The primary advantage is disaster recovery. Mm. Oh, my God. You know, they are actually talking about a lot of the service providers in New Orleans during the big flood. By being able to have this replication, some of the corporations that were using the replication actually shifted their operations into the cloud when their data centers got flooded and then came back without any trouble at all because of the replication. In fact, Microsoft has even gone as far as giving you some very, very granular control over replication. Not only that, Microsoft has also added in a lot of global load balancing type features. Right now, it's still DNS round robin, which is kind of lame, but it's a first step. I did talk to the product managers, and they're saying, yeah, they understand that round robin is lame, but it's a first start, and it does work. So we probably ought to start. We'll probably start seeing some new announcements on being able to do more control over load balancing. Heck, they even added BGP capability into the server operating system, so that your servers could actually go and control your inter-domain communications. Pretty powerful, and I was actually really shocked at how much changes they did in R2.
Mm-hmm. I like that. Now, let's move beyond the server operating system, because we understand that that's always a good thing. Whenever Microsoft starts building in features like OpenStack, like features into their operating system, that gives us more choice, more flexibility. Was there much movement on, say, the Office side? Curtis, let me throw this over to you.
I don't think there was a ton of movement on the Office side. What you're seeing over there is really some smaller tweaks. You are seeing a greater reliance on the cloud as a model for where things happen with Office. Some of this has to do with the consumer side, where they want things like Office 365 to be the model going forward in terms of licensing. More of it, though, has to do with what Microsoft sees as the new model of collaboration. You really get the feeling that they believe that the computer's primary use moving forward will be that collaborative function, rather than simply, you know, putting words on paper or making a chart out of some numbers. The collaborative function comes up again and again and again, and both Azure and the public clouds are ways to make that happen. That's where the security comes in. That's where being able to do a single authentication across multiple cloud types comes in. And that's where multiple device types being able to get to the one central data store becomes an enormous issue for Microsoft and its customers.
Oh, we're going to come right back to that to talk all about real-time collaboration. But first, I want to take one last break to talk about the last sponsor of the show, and that's Hover. Now, are you looking for an easy-to-use, honest, reliable provider for name registration and management? Well, if you are, then you've got to check out Hover. Now, Hover makes it easy. They believe that everyone should be able to take control of their online identity with their own domain name, and they make it easy for you to do so. They take the hassle out of owning and managing domain names with smart, easy-to-use, friction-free, and powerful domain name management tools. Hover is all about honesty. They don't believe in heavy-handed upselling or aggressive cross-selling. They sell you what you need, and then they do what they say they're going to do. They don't believe in hiding functionality or requiring extra payments for things that should be included with your domain name management. Things like Whois privacy, subdomains, and URL forwarding. They also keep it real. They offer services that enhance the domain name experience. They will only ever partner with companies that they believe offer their customers value and those whose values mirror their own. They offer email that makes it easy and affordable to create a memorable email address and eschew the impersonal free webmail email addresses that just seem so unprofessional. Hover also offers you choice. They offer 23 top-level domains, TLDs, like the popular .com, .net, and .org, as well as .tv, .pro, .mobi, and .biz. Hover also offers the most popular country code TLDs, like .ca, .asia, .us, and .uk. Now, we all know that many .com addresses are just not available these days, so they offer you the .net addresses that you want. There are a lot of unusual .whatever choices out there, and there are more coming. But .net is really the one alternative to .com that everyone recognizes and accepts. Hover is here to help you for the long haul. You don't have to worry about being left out in the lurch. They offer excellent online help, support documentation, and tutorials covering everything from moving domain names to Hover, setting up redirects and domain forwards, pointing DNS to the most popular web hosting services, and much, much more. Hover offers no hold, no wait, and no transfer phone support. Call 1-866-731-6556, Monday to Friday, 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And you'll be speaking to a live person who is empowered and eager to help. Hover is also a part of Tucows, for us old geeks, a company that has been around since 1994 and that is one of the largest domain name registrars in the world. So here's what I'd like you to do. I want you to visit Hover today at hover.com/enterprise. To register your domain name, use our offer code ENTERPRISE and get 10% off. That's hover.com/enterprise, offer code ENTERPRISE. And we thank Hover for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's close it out. Last bits of news out of Tech Ed. You guys were there for a long time. What do people need to know about Microsoft's strategy in servers, in workstation, in cloud services? What is the energy building behind? What is the buzz?
Well, a lot of it is, you know, Microsoft is a company that they're iterative. They are a company where they have the ability to integrate and collaborate across many, many divisions. They don't always do it well, but the opportunity is there. So we're going to start seeing more and more things where Office talks to UC, the talks to the server and so forth. There's a lot of glue that puts everything together, and don't count them out. Microsoft is one heck of an engine to compete with. And they've got some great, great offerings that are coming up.
Curtis, last words?
I think that one of the things that I saw is that while they were talking about a whole raft of new products, both in hardware and in software, one of the things that they clearly recognize is that they are no longer likely to be the only set of products in a corporation. So they're expanding the ways in which they can bring other products into the Microsoft managed universe and make them all work together in a unified whole for the modern enterprise.
Well, gentlemen, I hate to cut it short. We are running a little shorter on an episode today because of WWDC, but that was a lot of information to cover in just 60 minutes. And you, that's right, you out there in the chat room listening to us on your audio system, you've spent another hour listening to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. No, that's right. I checked. I looked it up, and the internet can't lie. Now, we want to make it easier for you to get this podcast because we know there's a lot of you who download it on a one-time or get it from a friend, but why do that? Why not just get the Twiat goodness delivered to the device of your choice each and every single week? That's right. If you go to twit.tv/Twiat, you'll see our little drop-down menus where you can find ways to get it dropped into your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device, your tablet, your phone, whatever it might be, even to your zombie Zoom, we make it easy for you to get the Twiat goodness to where you need it. Also, did you know that we have a YouTube page? That's right. And it's not just because we want to be on YouTube. It's because we're offering all sorts of functionality. Not only will you be able to get all of our episodes in YouTube quality, not only will you be able to hang out with us when we do actually start doing our hangouts, but you'll be able to watch all of our pre-recorded episodes. We're uploading them for your purposes of education. That's right, Stuff My IT Guy Says, the Data Closet Pro Gear Pro Tip, everything will be there for your listening and watching pleasure. Also, did you know that you could follow me on Twitter? That's right. If you go to twitter.com/PadreSJ, you'll be able to find out what I'm doing on a daily. You'll be able to comment on past episodes, and you'll be able to suggest topics for future episodes of Twiat. This is the kind of engagement we've got. This is the love we have for the Twiat Riot. Finally, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at noon, you can go to live.twit.tv. And if you watch before the show, you get to see what goes into creating a show like Twiat. And if you watch after, you can see all the fun that we'd have when, the cameras are supposed to be off. It's part of the making the sausage that is so popular with Twit TV. I want to thank CyberDog in the chat room for helping us with the show notes, and also for everyone here in the studio who makes this show possible. To Carsten, our super producer, and to Jason. Oh, Jason. That's right, Jason. Jason, our technical director. I've heard that you actually have a show on the Twit TV network that might be all about the next generation of mobile devices. What do you call that thing?
It's called All About iOS. And wait a minute. No, sorry. That's the other show. It's called All About Android.
That's right. Oh, I always get those confused.
Yeah, on today in particular because of WWDC. But yeah. You can catch it live every Tuesday, 5 p.m. Pacific at live.twit.tv, or get it subscribed to All About Android at twit.tv/AAA.
You need to watch it because the more you know, the more you do good things. No, that's a different show. I'm Father Robert Ballester, and remember, want to know what's going on in the enterprise? Just keep quiet.